I want you to picture a massive steel beam. You know the type, holding up a bridge or framing a skyscraper. It's cold, heavy, and it looks completely solid, immovable.
Right.
Now, what if I told you that inside that beam, there's a battlefield?
A battlefield. That's a bit of a dramatic start.
I'm serious. Deep inside that steel, down at a scale so small you can't even see it with a normal microscope, there is a war going on. It's a war against heat, against time, and really against the fundamental laws of thermodynamics.
Okay.
And the weapon that wins this war, it's not more iron, it's a pinch of dust.
Magic dust, effectively.
Yeah, invisible strength. And that's the theme of our deep dives today. We are looking at a really fascinating PhD thesis by Jaehoon Jang from Pohang University of Science and Technology from 2012.
And the title is a bit of a mouthful.
It is the effect of MOW, or W, on tick coarsening in HSLA steel.
But don't let the acronym scare you. This research is, it's essentially the blueprint for the modern automotive industry. It's all about how we make cars that are light enough to save gas, but strong enough to save your life.
And it all comes down to what you could call atomic engineering. So let's just, strip away the jargon. We've got molybdenum, tungsten, titanium carbide, and this HSLA steel. What is the actual mission here?
The mission is to solve paradox. You want steel that is incredibly hard so it doesn't just crumple in a crash, but you also need to be able to bend it.
Right, into the shape of a car door without it snapping.
And you have to do it cheaply. This thesis explores how adding a tiny, tiny amount of these specific elements, molybdenum or tungsten, completely changes the atomic landscape to make that possible.
Okay, so before we get to the solution, the molybdenum, we need to understand the material itself. HSLA steel. This isn't the same stuff they used to build, say, the Titanic, is it?
No, definitely not. HSLA stands for high strength low alloy, and that low alloy part is key.
Okay.
In the old days, if you wanted strong steel, you just dumped expensive metals in there. Nickel, chromium, by the bucket load. With HSLA, you're using mostly iron, but you're tweaking the microstructure to get that high performance.
So how do you tweak a block of iron to make it stronger without just making it heavier?
You use precipitates. This is the magic dust we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, in this case, titanium carbide or TiC.
Precipitates. To me, that sounds like rain.
In meteorology, yeah. But in metallurgy, precipitation is when a solid particle forms inside another solid. So imagine you're a block of steel, and inside of it, millions of tiny hard particles just
Like
materialize.
chocolate chips in a cookie.
If the chocolate chips were made of diamond and were microscopic, yes. We are talking about particles that are less than 10 nanometers wide.
10 nanometers. I feel like we toss around the word nano a lot. Can you ground that for us?
Sure. A human hair is about, what, 80 to 100,000 nanometers wide?
100,000.
So you could fit thousands of these things across the width of a single hair. They're virtually invisible.
So this is the part I always struggle with. How does a tiny speck, something, a 10,000th the width of a hair, stop a 2-ton car from crushing?
It comes down to how metal actually dens. We tend to think of steel as rigid, right?
Yeah, completely solid.
But at the atomic level, when you bend a piece of metal, you actually have layers of atoms sliding over each other. We call the lines where this happens dislocations.
Okay, so bending is just atoms sliding.
Right. Think of the steel matrix like a flowing stream. The water is those dislocations moving. If the water flows smoothly, the steel is soft, it bends easily. But if you dump a bunch of rocks into that stream,
The water gets blocked. It has to work harder to get around them.
exactly. The titanium carbide particles are the rocks. They pin the dislocations in place. This is formally known as the Orowin-Ashby mechanism.
Okay.
The dislocations hit these hard particles, they get stuck, and they need way more energy to move. And that extra energy requirement, that's what we call strength.
So logic says more rocks equals stronger steel.
Yes, but it's not just the amount of rocks, it's the size. And this is a crucial insight from the thesis.
Smaller is better.
Much, much better. Imagine you have a bucket. You can fill it with one giant boulder, or you can fill it with a million tiny pebbles. The total volume of rock is the same.
Right.
But if you pour water in, which one creates more
The
obstacles?
million pebbles. The water has to navigate around every single one. The boulder just sits there and the water flows right around it.
Precisely. Surface area and distribution are key. The thesis points out that a 1 nanometer particle is 1,000 times more effective at strengthening than a 10 nanometer particle for the same amount of material.
Wow, 1,000 times. That's an exponential difference. So the game isn't just add titanium carbide, it's keep the titanium carbide as small as humanly possible.
Correct. And that is where things tend to go wrong.
Before we get to the disaster, how do we even get these particles in there? You can't just, you know, inject them with a syringe.
No, no. They have to grow there naturally. And the thesis details this process called interphase precipitation.
Sounds complex.
It's actually quite beautiful. Steel changes its crystal structure depending on the temperature. When it's glowing red hot, it's in a phase called austenite. As it cools, it transforms into ferrite, which is the structure at room temperature.
So hot austenite turns into cool ferrite.
Got it. And imagine the boundary between those two phases. It's like a wall moving through the metal. On one side, it's austenite. On the other, it's becoming ferrite. As this wall moves, it acts like a farmer planting a field.
A farmer.
Yes. The boundary doesn't move smoothly. It moves in little jumps or steps. This is called the ledge mechanism. So the boundary jumps forward, it pauses for a split second, and while it's paused, it drops carbon and titanium out of the solution.
It's planting the seeds.
Exactly. It forms a row of these tiny titanium carbide particles. Then it jumps again, pauses, and plants another row.
The thesis has these images from a transmission electron microscope. The TEM images.
Mm.
And you can actually see this, can't you? It looks like sheets of dots.
Yeah.
You can. It looks like perfectly organized rows of corn in a field. When this happens correctly, you get these beautiful sheets of extremely fine 1 nanometer particles. The steel is just loaded with potential strength.
But of course, there's a villain. We've made the perfect steel. We've rolled it out. What happens next?
The coiling stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's the practical reality of manufacturing. You can't just make a mile-long sheet of steel and carry it around. You have to roll it up into a giant coil to put it on a truck or a ship.
Okay, standard logistics. You have to move this stuff.
The problem is the heat. These coils are massive. They weigh tons. When you roll them up, they're still hot around 600 degrees Celsius.
Right.
And because they're so big, they stay hot for a long, long time. It's like a massive thermal blanket.
So our perfect little 1 nanometer particles are sitting in a 600 degrees sauna for hours.
Or even days. And they hate it. This triggers a phenomenon called coarsening or Ostwald ripening.
Ostwald ripening. I've actually heard that term in cooking with ice cream.
It's the exact same principle. If you let ice cream melt and refreeze, it gets crunchy. The tiny ice crystals merge to form big, gross ice chunks.
Ah.
In steel, the tiny titanium carbide particles dissolve and they feed the larger ones.
So it's a big fish eat small fish scenario.
That is exactly how the LSW theory, which is referenced in the thesis, describes it. Nature prefers big particles. They have less surface area relative to their volume, so they're more stable. So the small particles sacrifice themselves. Their atoms diffuse through the steel and attach to the big particles.
So we lose our million pebbles, and we end up with the one big boulder.
And remember, that boulder is 1,000 times less effective. The steel loses its strength. The thesis actually ran an experiment to prove this. They took a titanium niobium steel and just baked it.
And how bad was the damage?
Catastrophic. At 700 degrees Celsius for just 40 minutes, the particles were perfect around 4 nanometers, but they left it for 120 hours.
Which is a long time, but I guess it's possible if a coil is sitting in a warehouse or just cooling really slowly.
Yeah,
exactly. After 120 hours, the particles grew to over 100 nanometers. They became monsters. And the strengthening effect, it evaporated.
So that's the central conflict. You have to coil the steel to move it, but coiling it ruins it.
Precisely. And this is where Jay Hoon Jang's research comes in. The industry had found a workaround, but they didn't really understand why it worked. They found that if you add just a pinch of molybdenum 0.2% by weight, the particles stay small.
Even in the sauna?
Even in the sauna, the coarsening slows down dramatically.
Okay, so molybdenum is the hero.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting part isn't that it works, it's why it works. Because the common theory was wrong, wasn't it?
It was. For a long time, metallurgists thought, well, molybdenum is a hard, high melting point metal. Maybe it just makes the carbide particle tougher.
Like building a house out of brick instead of straw.
Right. If the particle is more stable, it won't dissolve. It makes intuitive sense.
Yeah, it does.
But the thesis used heavy-duty computational physics to look at the atoms, and it found the exact opposite. Molybdenum makes the particle less stable.
Wait, hang on. It makes the particle less stable, but that prevents it from breaking down. That sounds completely backward.
It really does. The calculations showed that the molybdenum atoms are actually rejected by the titanium carbide. They don't want to be inside that crystal structure. The particle would be chemically happier if the molybdenum just left.
So if the molybdenum is making the particle unhappy, why does that stop the coarsening?
Because coarsening isn't just about how stable the particle is on the inside, it's about how the particle fits into the steel around it. It's about something called interfacial energy.
Interfacial energy. Okay, break that down.
Think of a puzzle. You have the steel matrix, which is ferrite, and you have the particle, titanium carbide. They both have these crystal lattices grids of atoms, but those grids aren't the same size.
The thesis calls this lattice misfit.
Right. And usually the titanium carbide lattice is about 6% larger than the ferrite matrix.
So it's like trying to force a puzzle piece into a hole that's 6% too small.
Exactly. You have to squeeze it in, and that creates stress. The atoms at the boundary, they're stretched, they're uncomfortable. That tension is high interfacial energy.
And nature hates tension.
Nature is lazy. It wants the lowest energy state possible. And one way to get rid of that tension is to reduce the amount of surface area where the two materials touch. And how do you do that? You combine all the small particles into one big one.
So the big fish eat small fish thing isn't random. It's happening because the small fish are uncomfortable in the steel. The particles are clumping together to minimize their contact with the matrix.
Bingo! That is the driving force. Now, enter molybdenum.
What does the Mo do to the puzzle piece?
When molybdenum forces its way into that carbide, even though it's chemically unstable, it physically changes the size of the lattice. It shrinks the
It
difference.
makes the shirt fit better.
It reduces the crystallographic misfit. So instead of a 6% difference, maybe it drops to 2% or 1%. Suddenly, the puzzle piece slides right in. The stress of the boundary just plummets.
And if there's no stress?
There's no driving force to clump together. The particles are perfectly happy to stay small and separate.
That is incredibly subtle. So it's not about making the particle an armored tank, it's about making it a good neighbor.
That's a great way to put it. It removes the motivation for coarsening. It's a huge shift from thinking about internal thermodynamics to thinking about interface mechanics.
I just love that we can figure this out. But how do we know this? The thesis mentions some pretty intense simulation methods, first principles calculations.
This is where modern metallurgy gets really sci-fi. You can't just look at an atom and measure its energy levels with a ruler. You have to solve the Schrödinger equation,
Quantum mechanics.
deep quantum mechanics. The thesis uses something called density functional theory, or DFT. It simulates the electron cloud around the atoms to predict exactly how they'll behave.
And there was a term in there that I honestly thought was a typo, the muffin tin sphere.
It is not a typo. It's a very famous approximation method in physics.
Please explain, because I am picturing baking right now.
It's a brilliant workaround. Solving the math for how all these electrons move is wildly difficult. The environment right near the nucleus of an atom is chaotic. But in the empty space between atoms, the interstitial region, the energy is pretty flat.
Okay, chaos near the center, calm in the middle.
So the muffin tin method mathematically draws a sphere around each atom. That's the muffin. Inside the muffin, they use one type of complex math. But in the space between them, the tin, they use much simpler math.
So they're literally dividing the universe into muffins and tins to make the math solvable.
Exactly. It simplifies the equations enough that a supercomputer can handle them. And this allowed Jehoon Jang to calculate all these lattice sizes and the stability without ever melting a single piece of metal.
But they did verify it with real metal, right? They didn't just trust the muffin.
Oh, yeah, they did the physical work too. They used dilatometry, which measures tiny expansions in the steel as it heats up, and they used something called carbon extraction replicas.
That sounded like a cloning technique.
It's a clever trick for using a microscope. If you try to look at these tiny particles while they're stuck inside a thick chunk of steel, the electron beam can't get through. The steel just blocks the view.
So, how do you get them out?
You polish the steel, then you coat it with a super thin layer of carbon. Then you put the whole thing in acid. The acid dissolves the steel matrix, but it doesn't hurt the carbon layer or the carbide particles.
The steel just melts away, leaving the carbon coating behind.
And the tiny particles are stuck to that carbon coating. You fish that coating out of the acid, put it in the microscope, and there you go. A perfect ghost image of the microstructure.
That is surprisingly low tech and high tech all at once.
And it confirms the theory. The molybdenum-doped steel showed significantly smaller particles after heat treatment compared to the standard steel. The good neighbor effect is real.
So molybdenum is the key. But the thesis ends with a look to the future. If the whole mechanism is just fixing the fit, shouldn't other elements work too?
Exactly. If the theory holds, anything that adjusts the lattice parameter of the carbide to match the ferrite should work. And the thesis points a finger directly at tungsten.
Tungsten. symbol W.
The calculations suggest tungsten would behave almost exactly like molybdenum. It predicts a whole new alloy system, TIWC, that resists coarsening through the exact same low interfacial energy mechanism.
So we might be seeing tungsten-infused steel in future cars.
It's very possible. Tungsten is heavier and more expensive, so there are trade-offs, of course. But scientifically, it validates the blueprint. It proves we understand the rules of the game now.
So let's bring this all back to the real world. Why should the person listening to this care about lattice miskits and muffin tin spheres?
Because if you drove to work today, you relied on the science. We need cars to be lighter. That's a non-negotiable goal for the planet, to reduce emissions and improve fuel economy. But we cannot sacrifice safety. We can't have cars that fold like paper in a crash.
So we need thinner steel that is somehow stronger?
Right. And the only way to manufacture that steel economically is to use these coiling processes where the steel stays hot for a long time. Without molybdenum fixing this coarsening problem, we couldn't mass produce these high-tech steels. We'd be stuck with heavier, less efficient vehicles.
It's a direct line from quantum mechanics to the sticker price and the safety rating on your car.
It is. It transforms a logistical nightmare hot coils destroying your steel into a total non-issue.
Okay, before we wrap up, I have to ask you about this time bomb idea. You mentioned this when we were going through the notes. It's a lingering question here that the thesis kind of hints at.
Yes, and it's a provocative one. We've established that molybdenum works because it reduces the interfacial energy. It fixes the fit.
Right.
However, we also established that molybdenum is thermodynamically unstable inside the carbide. It technically wants to leave.
It's staying there because it's trapped, not because it likes it. It's the unhappy roommate.
Exactly. So in the short-term hours of manufacturing, even weeks, it stays put. But what about the long-term? What about 10 years, 20 years?
If you have an old car, or maybe a bridge made of this steel.
If given enough time and energy, would that molybdenum eventually get kicked out of the carbide? Because if it does, the fit suddenly gets bad again. The interfacial energy would spike.
And the coarsening would start.
Theoretically, you could have a microstructure that looks perfectly fine for decades and then internally begins to degrade as chemical equilibrium slowly reasserts itself.
It's a sudden catastrophic loss of strength.
Now, to be clear, diffusion at room temperature is incredibly slow. We are talking glacial speeds. It's unlikely to cause your car to fall apart in the driveway tomorrow. But scientifically, the system is under tension. It's not in its true final state.
That is a slightly unsettling thought to end on. A reminder that even solid steel is this dynamic living thing at the atomic level.
It keeps metallurgists up at night. And it keeps us in a job. We're always looking for that perfect balance.
I bet it does. Well, this has been a fascinating journey into the invisible. Thank you for helping us decode the secret life of steel.
My pleasure. It's always fun to look under the hood.
And to you listening, next time you get in your car, take a second to appreciate the trillions of tiny nanometer-sized rocks keeping you safe. Thanks for listening to this deep dive. We'll see you next time.